I'm well.
Well, this is where my heart, can y'all hear my heart? Hi everyone, I'm Martha. I'm a very grateful member of Al-Anon. Thank you so much for having me, Lisa, and thank you all for having me today. I really appreciate it. Before I get started, I just want to say I've had a very awesome life. There were times in my life where I did not have that perspective or that attitude, but now where I am right now, I realize how blessed and how awesome my life has been, and I just want to express that gratitude up front before I get started here. But I had a great childhood, but I mean, there is some stuff that I can go ahead and start out that probably formed the way my thinking developed through the years. I was born in Tulsa in 1961. My parents were older parents. My dad was a World War II veteran, and they had been married 10 years before they had my older brother, and then another 5 years before I came along. So they were kind of older than the rest of the parents, and I was also raised by my maternal grandparents. I spent pretty much every weekend with them until I was in high school. And the thing about my mother was an only child, and the thing that I know now about my maternal grandparents is that my mother told me later on in years that my grandfather, before I was born, he was a drinker, and before I was born, some men came to the house and took him away and got him sober and brought him back, and I never saw him touch a drop of alcohol. And I don't know whether he was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, but he certainly was the most serene, wonderful, gentle man that I ever knew. And the one thing that I will say is that my grandmother, on the other hand, was a great candidate for Al-Anon, I think. I know for sure she probably never went to Al-Anon, but she was a world-class worrier, and she was especially worried and said rosary after rosary after rosary whenever my grandpa would go fishing. So I had maybe a feeling there was some, looking back, I'm like, maybe there was some PTSD there or something, but they just loved the heck out of me, and as I said, my mother was an only child, and I think that there was some history there with alcoholism with my maternal grandparents. So I think, that I was very early on, I think maybe I was born with a level of kind of a self-conscious, felt different type thing. And my brother, who was 5 years older than me, I don't think was real thrilled when I came along. I think he and my mom had a good thing going, and there was a lot of, he did a lot of mean, almost abusive things behind their back. I didn't really feel like they really ever addressed it, so I just told myself it was behind their back and they didn't know. But his little nickname for me was Fatty, and I went to private schools for 12 years, and in grade school I was kind of a member of this little girl clique where there was a very mean girl. So I kind of had a mean girl at school during the day and a kind of abusive brother and teen mom at home. And so it was an interesting kind of way to, I always just felt a little bit different. But the one thing I could do better than him was I could eat and I could make straight A's. He wasn't much of an eater and he wasn't good at school, so I really excelled at those things that he didn't. So in grade school I was taller than everyone in my class. I think I was taller than everyone in the school. In fact, I think I was 5'8" by the time I was in the fourth grade. And in the during that time, in the in the early or the late 60s, early 70s, tall girls were not really in. Now they seem to be taller, and that's fine. But I was very self-conscious about my height, and I could not. We wore uniforms to school. We got to dress in normal clothes once a week, and I never could fit. And I was a little chunky, and I never could really fit in, store-bought clothes. They weren't long enough. We had to have long, you had to have knee-length stuff at those schools. So, a mother found a pattern that she particularly loved, and she made me, whenever I wanted a new dress, I got that same dress in a different color. And I'm going to tell y'all right now, I'm sure some of you, I can tell some of you are of my era. I wanted to be Marsha Brady. My dream was to be Marsha Brady, and I was at best a kind of a chubby Jan with a pixie haircut, and Mother would not let me have long hair. I mean, that was one of her rules. I could not have long hair. I had to wear this, these clothes that she made, and I just, because my parents were older, I think that they did their best, but they just weren't really, they just seemed like their ideas were a little bit older than the other parents. But around the age of 8, I noticed that my mom, when friends would come over, she would act different when the friends came over, and I was really embarrassed the way she acted when friends came over. And it didn't compute at first, but she was a nightly drinker. I do not know whether she was an alcoholic, but she did, her drinking did affect me, and she did drink a lot every night. And we went to California on a trip, and my dad stayed home, and when we came home, he had bought one of those brand new big colored console TVs they had back then, and he took the black and white and went to the bedroom, and that's kind of where how they lived their life for 65 years. He stayed in the bedroom, she stayed in the living room. When dinner was over, he went to the bedroom. When dinner was over, she went to the living room and she drank. She drank nightly, and I loved her a lot until dinner time, and then after dinner time, I didn't really like her so much. And she was never abusive, and she was never mean to me, but she did like to get on the phone, and when she would get to drinking, and I'd be in my room, and it would just like really embarrass me. And But anyway, finally about the 8th grade, she let me grow my hair out, and I started looking a little bit more like Marsha Brady. I felt a little bit more comfortable. And I went off to high school, and I guess it was probably around sophomore, junior year, my best friend started smoking pot, and she was kind of a wild child, and she had a guy that she liked, and this guy came over to her house and brought a friend with him, and I knew the friend because when I got to high school, there were actually boys there that were taller than me, and this guy was one of them. And we went out in this fast. This guy had I'll never forget, it was an orange duster, and he was a kind of a spoiled kid, and he always had hot rods. And so this was the guy that liked her, and his friend was this tall guy. And I don't know, one thing led to another. There might have been some beer drinking going on, and there was a kiss that night between me and this tall guy. And now I have heard alcoholics say that, their first drink, they were suddenly like the most awesome. Everything fell into place as soon as they took their first drink. Well, I'm going to tell you that that kiss, I was suddenly Marsha Brady. I mean, I was full-blown Marsha Brady. I was that girl, that pretty girl that I'd always wanted to be, and I was hooked. And he didn't. There's where the love story began, and he didn't really know what he had in store for him. But I think it took him about. He left some albums in my car. And to this day, I remember one was Who's Next by The Who, and one was Eric Clapton. I still can't remember what the third one was, but he left him in my car, and I thought that surely he would want those albums. Why wasn't he calling me to get those albums? Because, see, the reason he left him in my car is because he was 15 and I was 16, and I had my license, and he didn't, so I had to drive him home. And but finally he called, I was hooked on him. The way he made me feel, that night. And and at that point I had kind of decided that the pot smokers and the beer drinkers were my people. That's who I was going to run with. That's the crowd that I felt most comfortable with after all those years of feeling somewhat out of place. I think some of the the don'ts were already kicking in. You know, I was doing the, I was kind of like always the one that could kind of hold it together and always the one doing the caretaking. And maybe there was a little bit of kind of holier than thou attitude mixed in there, but those became my people. And it's funny, today they still are. A lot of them are sober. but this guy, this tall guy was, he was, you know, he was one of the pot smokers and the beer drinkers, but he was also an athlete. He played sports. He was friends with everybody. He was, you know, always watched out for the underdog. And I just thought he was, and he was so handsome. I thought he was so handsome, and he had all that stuff going for him, and he liked me. And so I was hooked. You know, I felt, like I say, I felt better than I'd ever felt. And there was one time in early on in that 15, 16-year-old relationship that we were at a bonfire before a football game, and he was standing with me, and I was just enjoying it and soaking it all in. And a girl came up who I didn't really know and asked him if he wanted to go get high, and man, he was out of there. I mean, he was like, oh, I'll see you later. You know, she's like, hey, you want to go get high? And he was like, okay, well, I got to go now. And I was like, wow. So I figured out right then that, you know, there was going to have to be more for him, for me to keep him around. And I started stealing this straight A student, you know, always doing the, you know, the teacher's pet, started stealing liquor from my parents' liquor cabinet to give to him. You know, and I guess I was kind of thinking, well, I'm just, well, it wasn't really mother's liquor that I was stealing, because she kept hers under the sink. You know, I'd catch her swigging out of the bottle under the sink. The liquor cabinet is where my dad kept his liquor and what he offered people when they came over. So, but I would steal liquor and I would give it to him, and he seemed to kind of hang around more whenever I had that liquor to, and then, so that was kind of the beginning of, you know, and that would continue. I mean, I knew that, you know, that he'd be around if I had some liquor to pull out of my purse. So anyway, it was off and on during high school, and mostly, well, he was always breaking up with me, and it would just devastate me. And my grades started slipping. I'd always been a straight A student. I started making F's. I started, you know, and it, you know, I know I was running with the pot smokers and the beer drinkers, but it was really more that I would get so distraught when he would break up with me and I would not pay attention to my grades, that kind of thing was happening. So he went off to Kansas City to go to school after high school, which kind of freaked me out a little bit. And I went to live with my grandparents for a while and helped my grandpa do some stuff. And it was kind of on again, off again during that. I did see a couple other people, but, you know, of course, as soon as he would find out, he would tell me to stop that, and I would. And towards the, after about a year of him being up there, I went up there to visit him one time, and it was a Memorial Day weekend, and well, I'm sure we obviously had a great old time, and I turned up pregnant after that trip, and I think that was all his fault. I'm pretty darn sure that was all his fault. So I was pregnant, and the religion that we were both raised in kind of frowned upon that type of thing. And we got married. We got married in his parents' living room, downstairs in the living room, by some guy. Not a priest, but a guy, and we were, I think both of us were of the thinking of that we were going to make this work, and we'll show them, you know, we'll show them. They might think that we're young and that we're stupid and that we've gotten ourselves into this mess, but we're going to show them. And I laugh because just recently I was looking back at our wedding pictures, and everybody looks like they're at a funeral. I mean, I didn't realize it at the time, but I was like, oh my God, they all look like they're at a funeral. That's, I think, kind of how they felt. He went back to school, and you know, I stayed in Tulsa, and he finally graduated and came home, and got a job, and you know, we were going to set up house in household in our I think it was 195 bills paid with the orange shag carpet, and we did, and our daughter was born in May of I should say that he was 19 and I was 20 when we got married, and our daughter was born in February of 1982, and so there suddenly we were two kids with a kid, and but she was the easiest child. She was the great baby, and things were going pretty well, and she was you know, his job was doing, he was doing well at his job, and we found a different apartment to live in, then about 5 months after our first daughter was born, I got pregnant again, and I'm certain that it was his fault again. I was pregnant again, and we moved into a house, a rent house, and we had that baby, and she was sickly, very sickly, and till she was about 6 months old, she couldn't hold down anything or put on weight, and it was very traumatic, and we were both pretty stressed, but you know, up until that point we'd been hanging in there pretty good, but I really went into one of our don'ts. This is when the don'ts really started kicking in, and I did all the don'ts. I had my do's and don'ts backwards, as we talk about, and I really went into a lot of self-pity at that point. I was young and I had these two little kids, and I had a husband that suddenly was drinking a lot more, and I mean, it wasn't just kind of like partying, you know, with all the people. It was kind of like he was drinking a lot more, and there was one instance when our second daughter was just brand new and we were going through all that stuff that I got up to feed her, and you know, self-pity took over and I lost my temper, and he was on the couch and I threw a beer can at him, and he said it was a full beer can, and I wasn't aiming, but he said it hit him in the head, and you know, that was like our first major blow up, and he didn't want to, he started kind of disappearing after that. And at one part, I think at one point, I think it was his drinking, but I think also he was kind of like, I don't think I want to come home. I mean, I was crazy. I was throwing stuff, and I was not, I was stressed out, and I was sickly all the time, and I had these two little babies, and he would disappear for, you know, sometimes a couple of days at a time, and I would run and tell his parents on him. And you know, I started thinking, this is where the forcing solutions started. I started thinking, I mean, at this point, I'm still not thinking that alcohol is really playing a role in this. And I started thinking, well, he doesn't really like renting this house. He was always complaining about renting. He wanted to own a house. So we bought a house, which I forced that solution. And we moved outside of Tulsa a little bit. And we had this house. And I felt for sure things were going to start looking up at that point, that things were going to get better and he was going to be around more, and you know, that was going to fix everything. And for a while things did get better. You know, that was, I thought, well, yeah, that helped, that really worked. But then that kind of wore off, and you know, there was a lot of you know, the first inkling I really had that possibly alcohol could be a problem was I noticed that on Sundays he was pouring whiskey in his beer, and I was like, well, that's not normal. I thought that just doesn't seem right, you know, why would you be needing to put whiskey in your beer? That just doesn't, you know, doesn't seem like respectable drinking, you know. And that was my first inkling that maybe, you know, that there was a problem there. And and then shortly thereafter, when I noticed that, his employer suggested that maybe he might want to do a rehab. And that was 1986, and rehabs were, you know, there wasn't as many of them, and I didn't know anything about rehab. He came home one day and he said, I think they made the suggestion, either you're going to do this or you're out of here. So that was kind of back in the day when employers gave you that option. I don't know that they do that so much anymore, but you know, now it's like you drug test, you're pretty much out of there. But back then you got that option of either treatment or lose your job. So he went to In 1986, he went to a 30-day treatment center, and I was distraught because they wouldn't let me talk to him. And I didn't, you know, now I know after, I mean, a few more rodeos that they don't usually let you talk to him the first few days. But so I went up there. Finally, they let me talk to him. And I guess I was just such a mess. They pulled me to the side and they were like, there's this program called Al-Anon for family members. And I was like, oh, okay. You know, and they sold it like, well, they said it would, they probably said it was for you, but what I heard was it will support him. And so, oh, you know, I want to support him. So yeah, I'll go to Al-Anon. I'll go check it out. So I remember I went up to an Al-Anon meeting at this treatment facility and went in, and I had a severe case of the hee-hees for, you know, probably a good 15 minutes. They let me talk about, he did this and he did this and he's doing that and he's doing that. And then finally this lady, I think I just put her over the edge, and she was what I call a black belt Al-Anon, but she pulled me aside. She stopped me right dead in front of everyone in the meeting, and she said, we don't care about what she set me straight. She said, we want to hear about you. We want to hear about what's going on with you. We're, you know, what's going on with him is what's going on with him, but this is for you. And I left that meeting, and I got in the car, and I drove home, and I cried all the way home. I thought, how could she be so mean to me? I'm the good one. Why would she talk to me that way? And I really, but you know, that lady became someone that I called. You know, I think that night I got an ODAT, and I still have that ODAT. It's been cried on, you know, spilled on. It looks like it's been through hell, but. You know, so I thought, well, I'm just going to give it a try. And so I started going to Al-Anon. He got out of rehab. And, you know, what they told me was that Al-Anon would help support his recovery. What I heard was, if you work a good Al-Anon program, he'll stay sober. That's what I heard. You know, so I was going to work that Al-Anon program, and that was going to keep him sober, and I was going to quit drinking and doing whatever I was doing, and I was going to, do this deal, and he was going to stay sober when he got out of treatment. And I was going to one meeting a week, and it was I was staying home with my kids at the time, and I went to this meeting, and it was all. It was mostly old-timers, double winners. Man, there was a lot of experience in there, and they were awesome. And I really, you know, I got a sponsor. I worked the steps. But still, I think in my mind, I thought, well, if I just worked those steps in a good amount of time and did what they told me to, he would stay sober. And it didn't work that way. He did not stay sober. I think he stayed sober a couple of months. But I kept going to Al-Anon for a couple of years, and stayed, you know, relatively sane. But then we moved back to Tulsa. We sold that house. We moved back to Tulsa. I got a job, and I quit going to that meeting. And I, you know. When you quit going to meetings, and when you convince yourself that what you're doing isn't keeping someone sober, so it's not worth it, you know, it slipped, you know. And I would run to emergency meetings, but after a couple of years, I really wasn't working a program. And so anyway, we were back in Tulsa, and you know, the drinking was. I was so scared. He'd gotten a DWI when we were living in that little town. But in Tulsa, if you got a DWI, your name got published in the paper. And I was so scared that he was gonna get another DWI, and my parents were gonna see it in the paper, because I kept this. I never told my parents any of this stuff. I mean, they didn't. You know, I didn't talk to my folks about this. His folks kind of knew what was going on, but not so much my folks. And So he got a job offer in Houston, and I guess it was 91. And I thought, well, again, forcing solutions, that's what he needs. He needs a new job, and everything's going to work out better if he just gets a new job. Because, I mean, this place, they told him to go to treatment, and then he didn't say sober, and they know it. And, you know, I just thought that if he could take this job and get a fresh start, that it was going to really solve all the problems. And we would get away from a lot of those old school friends that were partying, and you know, all while this was going on, we were living in Our all of our people that we hung out with were pot smokers and cocaine dealers and drinkers. And I mean, we were around all these people all the time. I thought, well, that's what he needs. We need to get away from all these people. And it's going to, you know, make everything better if we move away. So we moved to Houston, and there was lots of times where he would detox himself at home, and I would think his intention was to, and I really don't know if I wanted him to stay. At first I think I wanted him to be sober, but then I just really wanted him to just drink like a normal person, you know, and it just never could really be that way. And he would detox at home when things got bad, and then stay sober for a little while, and then start drinking again, and it would devastate me. I would just, you know, I would relapse with him, and, you know, it was just, when he would stay sober for a couple of months and then start drinking again, I would turn into this, I would just like lose it. You know, I wasn't, you know, I would read my literature, but I wasn't going to meetings. I would hit a kind of an emergency meeting every once in a while, and, but not necessarily commit myself to the program. I was listening to a speaker not too long ago, and she compared living with her alcoholic to kind of like a slot machine. And I thought, man, that I can really relate to that, because it would be like, you know, you know, you sit there and just over and over again, and bat, you know, stuff just keeps happening, and then something would happen, and it was like, oh, it's like I hit the lot, you know, it all would come out, and everything would be fine for a while, you know, and then it was back to the, you know, you didn't really want to get up and leave that machine, because, God, if you went over there and started that machine, then someone might sit down and get the big payoff from that machine, and I really related to that, and that's kind of how it was, and that's what the disease being so baffling, that it would be like he would listen to me sometimes, and he would do what I told him to do sometimes, and then other times, and you just never knew when, the whole don't lose your temper, or, things that are now, you know, one of our don'ts is don't argue with a drunk alcoholic. And now to me, that just seems like common sense. But back then, don't argue with a drunk alcoholic. Are you kidding me? I could not help myself. I mean, and I did the whole like, and I would start the fights. And sometimes they'd get physical and they'd get out of hand. But, you know, one of my favorite ways to start a fight was to say, have you been drinking? And, you know, the guy's on the floor, you know. I mean, what kind of person asks someone passed out on the floor if they've been drinking? Or are you wasted? You know, I mean, but that's how the fights would start. And usually his answer was no. And that pissed me off, you know. I mean, just say yes. But his answer was always no. I mean, he could have really stopped the whole thing if he would just said, yeah, you know. But it was always no. It didn't matter how messed up he was. It was always no. I haven't been drinking. but you know, I kept asking the question. I kept, you know, the insanity over and over again, expecting different results. And it got to where, I could just probably have pushed a tape recorder for every fight. But you know, our daughters, bless their hearts, they, you know, I'm sure they learned to cope. I wish, you know. I looked at, you know, back in the days when they were little, and I thought, oh, how to get myself into this. Today they are the best gift that God ever gave me. And but they, you know, they lived through some stuff. And I'm sure if you would ask them today, you know, who was the crazy one, they would probably say Mom, because I was the one. You know, he was drunk, and they knew that. And most of the time he was just either in the backyard or on the floor, and I was the one, you know, slamming doors and starting fights and you know, trying to keep, but to an extent also trying to keep him from embarrassing me like my mom did. You know, I was that whole like, as the disease progressed in our life, in our lives, in our home, we became very isolated as what happens in the disease. And, you know, we didn't really have a whole lot of friends, because I had all that I could handle trying to keep him from getting in trouble and embarrassing me and keep him from upsetting the kids. And my youngest daughter and him had a very rocky relationship. I mean, they're like this now. They're very tight. They've always been like that, but they also had a very rocky relationship. The older one, more like me and my dad. Well, not, I mean, more like my dad. She would just go to her room, you know. But my younger daughter was always up in his face, always kind of confronting him about stuff. And, you know, there was some fights between them that I had to get in between. And, you know, there were some visits to Harris County Jail and, you know, just all this stuff that goes along with the disease. And I was always just there, you know, bailing him out. I remember the first time that I got a call from Harris County, I got up in the middle of the night, went to the bail bondsman somewhere, you know, went down there, and I think I sat and waited for him to come out of jail. Well, I learned after a couple times of that he found his way home. I mean, I didn't really have to do that. He knew where the bus service was, and he found his way home, and I was like, well, you know, that taught me something. So, but, you know, the kids, they grew up, they went to college, they went to U of H, they got out of the house, and I was really relieved when they got out of the house because I didn't feel like they were going to be exposed to it anymore. And so it took, even though I hated to see them move out, it was very traumatic. It was, you know, kind of took something off me because I thought, well, they don't have to be around this mess anymore. Because by this time, to tell you the truth, I had quit going to any Al-Anon meetings, and I was so stuck in the don'ts that, and, you know, couldn't, you know, I just got hopeless, you know, and I really felt like, you know, that the only way I was just, you know, it was just going to be this way. And, the kids got older, and, my younger daughter got married, and it turned into kind of like a family drinking thing. They would come over, because, you know, I was cool with drinking on the weekends, they would come over, and we were all, it was like the whole family's drinking together. And after a while, I started thinking, you know, this doesn't feel like a healthy emotional atmosphere in my home, you know. And kind of lost track of where I am now. The kids are gone. Drinking's, you know. Oh, this is okay. So basically, you know, for him, I think as the disease is progressing in our house, you know, it started progressing to where he was not able. He was always able to have a job, and he was always able to be, you know, to help support the family. And so, as we know, as the disease progressed, that started, you know, the jobs, jails, fights, you know, that was all going on. The jobs, he started having trouble keeping jobs, and you know, people did not, they liked him, they didn't, you know, want to let him go. But that started to be an issue, and I think that really is where he kind of started. It really started affecting him is when he started losing the jobs. But, you know, I really thought, though, that, you know, I hear people speak sometimes and say they had thoughts of of murdering their spouses. I never really had that thought, because I knew I couldn't live with him, and I felt like I couldn't live with him and I couldn't live without him. But I really did think at one point that the only way that things were going to get better was for one of us to die. And it was a pretty hopeless situation. And but I didn't, even though I didn't want him to die, I got to a point where my plan was, I was thinking that my daughters were grown at this point, and I was thinking, man, I think I'm just going to let him pass out, and then I'm going to have someone come get him and take him somewhere. You know, I really started trying to plan this out in my mind. I was like, I'm going to get his brothers to come get him. He had lost a brother to the disease that hit him very hard. That was a difficult time, but he had a couple other brothers, and I thought, I'm just going to have him come get him and take him somewhere. But instead, I'm going to talk to him first and tell him this is what I'm thinking. And so I found a Sunday afternoon where he was sober enough, and my younger daughter came with me outside to talk to him, and we talked to him. And, you know, I told him, I said, you know, I'm really at a point where I think I'm just going to wait for you to pass out and have someone come take you somewhere because I just can't do this anymore. And a couple days later, this was in 2010, he decided to go into treatment again. And like I say, there had been many home detoxes. He had actually gone in the mid-90s, he went in inpatient detox. And you know, I had kind of gotten to the point where I didn't even know if I wanted him to try to get sober because I was always so devastated when it didn't last that I was kind of like, I just don't know if I can go through this again. You know, I just don't know if I can have him be sober for a while and then not be. It was just, I just didn't know. But at that point when he said he was going to go for treatment, I was like, okay. So we went into treatment and I was just so relieved for a few days. He was not in the house. He was gone. And then I had that memory. I was like, oh God, they're probably going to tell me to go back to Al-Anon. Damn, that's a lot of work. I don't know if I really want to do that because, you know, it is a lot of work. And I knew I was going to have to look at myself and I was going to have to look at my part in it. And it was like, I just don't know if I'm up for that. And so I went to a family thing and there was a lady in there that was a member of Al-Anon and she said something and made me know, oh God, I do. I've got to go back to Al-Anon. I think, you know, she said something about it being that, you know, my choice. And by this point, I had it up to here with people telling me what I needed to do. Even my own daughters had gotten to the point where I think they wanted me to leave their dad. They were just like, you know, when your own grown daughters are saying, you got to get out of there, you're like, ugh. You know, but you know, if I had known how to handle it, I would have, and I didn't. And so anyway, I went to an Al-Anon meeting, and I immediately knew I was home. I was like, oh my God, why have I not been doing this? You know, why? You know, I knew everything about Al-Anon from my, you know, from my first time around and my readings and my books and stuff. But I didn't want to look at myself. I didn't want to look at my part in it. You know, it was all about him. And even though I knew deep down inside that wasn't the truth, I knew that I was, you know, that there was things I could do for myself to make myself feel better. I still want to always make it all about him. All, you know, if he would just get sober, that's all we ever thought about, you know. And so I went back to Al-Anon in 2010, and I immediately felt home. And nobody gets me like the people in the Al-Anon rooms. I mean, I am just, you all are my people. And I, you know, I knew right away that that's where I needed to go. I didn't even really do much of the aftercare that the hospital provided because I would go in there and all I could think of was I'd look around these people. Oh my God, these people need Al-Anon. I got to go to Al-Anon. So I didn't do a whole lot of that, but I did get back into Al-Anon and I got a sponsor and started working the steps again. And he was doing pretty well. And the first year was rough, though. He was, I think he made, it was about 5 months and he relapsed. And which was a gift for me because I think I got my gift of desperation at that point because I'd been going to enough meetings that I was like, you know, well, it hit me really hard, but I had developed friendships with people that were there for me and they were not going to let me go in the ditch. It was hard, but I kept going to meetings and, you know, I walked into meetings and, I remember I had a friend that, I said, I don't want to go to meetings and have people ask me how my husband's doing. And she's like, well, just write down a piece of paper. I don't want to talk about that when they say that, just pull it out of your talk and say, I don't want to talk about that, you know? And I told another, I told my sponsor, I don't want to go to meetings cause I'm afraid I'll just sit there and cry. And she's like, so, you know, I mean, and it is so, but now I know that. But at the time, I was, you know, still young. I mean, I was still early reworking my program, and so the first year was rough. And I think, you know, I looked in the mirror one day and realized that I actually went to Heart to Heart, and I came home, and I thought he ended up in a like a kind of like a One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest place in Houston, and. This was kind of pivotal for me because I had people kind of telling me like maybe I should drop the act, you know, do the hard Al-Anon, and that just wasn't me. I wasn't there yet, and I'd like, you know, I can't go down there and tell them he can't come home. I just can't do that. That's just not. I wasn't anywhere near that place in my program. If I were ever was at that place, you know, I just wasn't near that. But what I prayed about it before I went down there to see him that day at that place. And you know what I was able to say? And it was such a God thing. I think he thought I was coming down there to get him out and bring him home. And all I knew was that I didn't want him to come home that day. I didn't know about tomorrow. I didn't know about our future. I didn't know anything about that, but I was strong enough to walk in there, and you know, and I knew I couldn't make a really hard boundary that I wasn't able to keep, but I was strong enough to walk in there that day and say he was ready to come home, and I said, I don't want you to come home today. And that was a huge step for me, you know, and that's what I tell people when, you know, they're trying to, I see people come in new and they're trying to set these great big old boundaries, you know, and I'm like, come on, you know, just, you know, you can change your mind tomorrow. Just, you know, today you can make a decision, you know, and, you know, and I did, I told him, I said, I just not ready for you to come home today. And it made him mad, you know, I think he kicked the ground like a little 5-year-old kid. And, But it became clear, and that's what we had a meeting, and then the counselor there had said, you know, you all have had this mother-son relationship for 30 years. And I was like, the light bulb went on. It's like, yep, I've been treating him like a 15-year-old guy, and I've been acting like a mom to him, you know. And so anyway, I left there, and he was mad at me, and you know, and I really didn't care, because I was okay with that decision for that day, you know. And I told myself when I left there, you know, that I could, we'll see what tomorrow brings, but today that's how I feel. And I got back to work, and I sat down at my desk, and for some reason, this little banner, I had the internet pulled up, and this little thing just went across the thing that set across my, I think it was on my mail, this little scrolling across, and it said, if you have God, you have everything. And I was like, I mean, it was just like a moment, you know. God had helped me through that thing. He'd helped me know the right thing to say. I'd prayed about the right thing to say, and when I got back, it was reinforced. And you know, I had given up on God. I thought God was for the people that went to church, and I didn't go to church. And I thought, and I don't know whether I had quit believing or if I just thought that there was no God for me when I started back into the program in 2010. And I started having little signs that I did have a God. I got so desperate that I decided I was going to start believing because the people that I had met in Al-Anon believed. That was really the only reason. I was like, well, I'm going to go all in on this deal because I'm desperate, and I don't want to be like this anymore. I'd taken a look in the mirror, and it was not good. And so I started really working the steps, and just acting as if, because the people that I cared about in the program did, and I respected them, and it had helped them. And you know, I worked my 4-step and started seeing that I had become things that I didn't know I was. I was, you know, I had become very manipulative, and I had to look at those things. I had to look at all the don'ts. I had to look at all the don'ts that I'd been doing, and the losing my temper, and you know, admitting my part in what had happened. You know, we didn't cause it, we can't cure it, we can't control it, but we can contribute. And the one thing I know today is that you know, I have a choice to not make situations worse. And I never made that choice. I used to make situations worse all the time. I mean, you know, but today I know the one thing that I can do is I don't have to make a situation worse. And so I hung in there, and the first year was really rough, and I kept going to my meetings, and I kept working my steps, and I kept being with my people and people that were, you know, my friends that were not going to let me go off into the to the ditch. And you know, I mean, he's had some sobriety, some good sobriety, and he drove me here today. He still makes me feel like Marsha Brady. It is a love story. We've been married 38 years. 38 years in July. Our daughters are 35 and 36. I don't know. They're not in any of the rooms yet. I know that Al-Anon would help them. They could possibly need to be in the other room. I don't know, but that's on their time. I need to stay out of that. You know, today I was thinking, you know, on the way here, I was nervous, and I thought, you know, I just... You know, you look back at your past, and you look back when you take your inventory and you kind of look at the way you acted, and you have some, maybe some regrets or whatever. I think I've kind of gotten through all that. You know, I think I've realized that, you know, I did the best I could with what I knew. And, you know, I wouldn't trade any of it, because it all was the road that led me here to you all today. I mean, I would not change a thing. The one thing that I, you know, was just thinking recently that, you know, it's like I did not have any gratitude. It was always like here's an example, like, you know, my husband would work some overtime and we'd have a little bit of extra money, and then the washing machine would break, and I'd be like, ugh. You know, instead of seeing that as a blessing, it'd be like, why does this always happen to us? You know, I missed so many opportunities for gratitude when I was in that poor me thing, and that's the part that I struggle with today. I was like, man, I where was the damn gratitude all those years? You know, I mean, there was so much there to be grateful for, but, you know, it's just so hard when the disease is ramped up and there's all that calamity and all that fighting and all that legal problems and you know, just things that we don't like to talk about. And but there was also so many things to feel grateful for, and a lot of good times. And you know, that was, you know, that's kind of where I am today. It's like, I don't want to miss any more gratitude opportunities, you know? And so every time I start to think about, you know, anything, I mean, even traffic, which everybody always has trouble with, you know, it's like gratitude, you know, and I'm telling you, it's just like, I don't want to miss any gratitude opportunities. I'm not getting any younger here, and I've missed a lot of gratitude opportunities, and I love to have that attitude of gratitude. And, you know, I love that you all read the AA promises. I love those. I would tell you that most of those have come true for me, are coming true for me. I'm not, you know, I'm definitely still on the road. And that's one thing I wanted to add too, is that, you know, back in my first round in AA, I mean, in Al-Anon, I thought, God, these people have got it made. There's no way I'm ever going to get to where they are, you know. And I kept seeing it as a destination. I thought, you know, and now I've stayed around enough to realize, no, that's not exactly how it works. It's ongoing. It's ongoing work. It's on, you know, serenity just doesn't fall in my lap. I have to work at it. Thankfully, it's coming a little bit more naturally to me now. It's, you know, the promise, intuitively knowing how to handle things that used to baffle us. You know, I do still get baffled, but at least I'm going to the right bag of tools these days, instead of the, you know, I used to, when my husband would be out drinking and not come home on time, I'd be scared and worried, and I would just pray for him to come home so I could be mad. Anger was my go-to, because we all know we want to be angry. Angry is better than being worried and upset and having your feelings hurt. So I would just pray for him to hurry and get up home so I could be angry, you know. And now I don't reach into that bag and pull out anger anymore. I've got, you know, more healthy tools now, and that's all because of the Al-Anon program. And you know, every day I have the choice to choose. Every day I have the choice to choose serenity and gratitude, and you know, it's up to me. And you know, you all told me that I could be happy whether the alcoholic is still drinking or not. You also told me it was okay that I loved an alcoholic. I came in here feeling like I was a bad person because I loved an alcoholic, because, you know, you get all those opinions, and you know you can divorce him, and you know, why the heck do you put up with that? And I was told, you know, it's okay that you love an alcoholic, and I immediately felt like I belonged. And you know, as long as I stay willing and keep working those steps and keep going to meetings, and you know, and which is, you know, the way I'm living my life today. I know it's a little bit early, but I don't want to ramble on. I've got one little thing here I want to say in closing. It's a little thing I read last week, and it just really kind of spoke to me. It says, it's from page March. It's March 22 from Courage to Change. It says, there is an innocence within me that already knows how to trust my higher power, to cherish life while holding it lightly, to live fully and simply in the present moment. I will allow that part of myself to come forward and nourish me as I continue on this journey. And, you know, that really is where I am right now. And that, and, you know, not wanting to lose another damn opportunity for gratitude, you know. I'm going to go ahead and stop a little bit early, you guys, so I don't ramble on. But thank you so much for having me today.